iTunes Podcast, and Google Play Music. The Latino Media Collective is recorded in WPFW Studios and airs Fridays at 1 p.m. on WPFW Washington.
Welcome to On the Margin with E. Ethelbert Miller. My guest today is Andy Shalaw. Andy Shalaw is a businessman and artist. He's the founder of Bus Boys and Poets, which was established in 2005. Andy Shalaw has just released the book, A Seat at the Table, The Making of Bus Boys and Poets. How are you doing this morning, Andy?
I'm doing great. Thank you so much, Ethelbert.
Right. You know, I got this book and I saw the title. I said, A Seat at the Table. And immediately I thought of Langston Hughes.
I thought you immediately got hungry.
That too. But I want to read this because I know you love Langston Hughes. And we know that this poem begins, I too sing America. I am the darker brother. They send me to eat in the kitchen when company comes, but I laugh and eat well and grow strong. Tomorrow I'll be at the table when company comes. Nobody will dare say to me, eat in the kitchen then. Besides, they'll see how beautiful I am and be ashamed. I too am America. I read that, Andy, because if we look at the first line of this poem, I am the darker brother. You deal with the issue of race and color in your memoir. But I want to first ask the question, when were you introduced to the poetry of Langston Hughes?
Very early. I was fortunate to be in a middle school that it was one of the first middle schools actually in Virginia to be desegregated. And the teacher that I had, I'd take a summer school English class. And in summer school, the teacher was a Black woman and she taught us poetry. And Langston Hughes was a major part of her conversation. I remember that very clearly. And I remember being, the thing about poetry, what I love is the words, of course, you know, they flow in a different way than you normally speak, you know, right. And it sort of opens up your mind to different ways of thinking. And she, she made us memorize. And of course, I didn't speak any English, but I could memorize. I could read the words and I can memorize them. So it was this incredible feeling of control of the language, even though you didn't understand what it meant, to be able to just recite it. And I was like, wow, you know, like my parents used to show me off. Andy, come on over here, you know, and recite some of that stuff, you know, blah, 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 blah. And I had no idea what I was saying, but it sounded really good.
And then years later, we'll say, okay, this rides into the naming of your restaurant, but we'll get into that later.
Yeah, yeah.
But I want to ask you this question. You came to the United States in 1966 at the age of 11. How is your story similar or different from other immigrant stories?
I came on a first-class flight on an airplane.
That's different.
Yeah, that's very different. My father was a diplomat, so we didn't have to wait in line. We got the VIP treatment. We went to the VIP lounge. We were met with dignitaries. We were driven by limousine to a hotel. Very, very different. That's not the story of most immigrants that come to this country. So we were not economic immigrants. We were not looking for a better life, so to speak. But then, stuff happened. The 67 war between the Arab countries and Israel took place, and things started to really change quite a bit. And so my father was the head of the Arab League, which was kind of like the United Nations of Arab countries. And he ended up, his position was pulled back because there was diplomatic severs between the countries, between the U.S. and other Arab countries. And so he decided, rather than return, he decided to stay. America was seen as this prize, come to America, because America's so far from Iraq. We went to Europe fairly regularly. We went to other parts of the world fairly regularly, but we never really thought of coming to America because that was a huge stretch.
You write about your father. Now there's a change happening in the household where your father gets an opportunity to perhaps teach in Utah, but he doesn't take that position in terms of taking the family out to Utah. And so he's forced to find another type of employment. Talk about that.
He was a professor, you know, he taught at Baghdad University, and he was, you know, an academic, and he wrote his poetry. His PhD was on Rubaiyat Umar al-Khayyam, which was the well-known Sufi poet. But he, you know, when he stopped working as a diplomat, he had to figure out a way to make a living. And the natural thing was for him to teach Arabic literature or Farsi literature or something like that. And he was offered a job. The jobs weren't plentiful for that kind of work. And so he was offered a job at Utah State and accepted the job. We were just ready, almost ready to leave. And then something happened. He met a friend who had a restaurant, a pizza place, you know, one of those greasy spoons in the middle of nowhere, and had just had some health issues and wanted to sell his place and retire. And my father was the recipient of that place. He ended up buying it and sort of make that his.
Well, let's look at that, you know, and this is why I asked about your story as well as many immigrant stories. We have sometimes, and I think of the Ethiopian community especially, where you have people who have, you know, writers, artists, things of that sort in their own country, but the only way they can get into the ground level of America is by opening up a restaurant.
Yeah.
You know.
I think a lot of it is you know, the opportunities are far less for immigrants. I think, you know, we're sort of back to square zero right now with the situation that's happening right now with this administration. But, you know, it's very hard for an immigrant to come and find a place in corporate America. You know, they just would not be able to succeed as well, especially if they have issues with language or they look or any of those things get in the way. America is a very racist country. So he ended up, you know, he wanted his independence. Teaching was one way of that. I mean, there's some independence as a professor at the university. There's a level.
Let's get into it because you have the memoir. I teach memoir workshops, and I was reading your book critically, and I started asking questions. I said, okay, I see this transition taking place with your father, and I'm wondering, okay, Andy, how are you different? Are your values from your father's?
We're very different people, I have to say. My father was pretty conservative, and I am not. And I think on many different levels, I kind of rejected everything that my father stood for. You know, he was a good enough guy, but we never really saw eye to eye. We never had a great relationship. Actually, until he was on his deathbed, which was interesting because the last few months of his life, I thought I got closest to him than I ever had. And I think it was just this vulnerability that happens when you're, you know, when you're at the very end of your life. And he was never a vulnerable kind of person. So to see that part of him was kind of refreshing, frankly. It was really kind of opened us up in a very different relationship.
Well, let's
spent quite a bit of time with him at that time.
Right. Let's look at something else when I'm thinking about memoir. You have a brother and sister. Okay, yeah. And I was wondering whether the impact of this making the decision in terms of lifestyle changing, you know, we also need the family working in a restaurant. How did that affect your brother and sister?
You mean like by when we ended up being in like family?
Right.
I mean, it was big because we were all involved at some level. My sister was too young at that time, I think, but she still used to come, you know, once in a while early in the morning on a Sunday, especially to clean up the tables and fill up the salt and pepper shakers and stuff like that. She was 9 years old at that time when we first got the place. And my brother and I, we were like probably 13, 15. And so we basically ran the show. I mean, we were very capable. We you know, It's either you sort of grow up fast.
Right. Well, we're going to get into that because I want to say right now for our listeners, your book is a really good read, Andy. I'll just tell you that it's a very good read. And I've known you a long time, but I enjoyed, you know, what I was finding out about you. But I wanted you to talk about three people who are very important to you. And they appear in the beginning and the front of your book. But then I'm going to go from your father to Howard Zinn, because I almost see Howard Zinn as being a father figure for you. Talk about how Howard Zinn and who he is for our listeners.
Howard was someone that I was so fortunate to meet because he really did change my life. I mean, I really did look up to him in a very sort of fatherly way, but also as a mentor, as a friend. He was someone that I got a chance to meet by some happenstance, and we hit it off immediately. And he had come to Washington to give a workshop on activism, on civic engagement, as what Howard was all about. He was, of course, the author of People's History of the United States. And I had a chance to sit with him and have lunch with him and have discussions with him. At the time, when I first met him, I was in awe, of course. I had read People's History, was so, you know, excited to meet the author of this paradigm-shifting book on American history. And I had a chance to sit with him, and we were having a conversation. He said, you know, he was funny. He had a great sense of humor, and also very serious about what he does, of course. And he was speaking about doing a play about Karl Marx, the father of communism. And so he was talking about it kind of, you know, because he wanted to make a lot of history accessible to ordinary people. He wanted them to be able to, you know, he wanted to reach them where they are. And he saw theater as a way to be able to promote ideas of history and things that oftentimes people don't read. Many people don't read the, you know, the works of Karl Marx or the Communist Manifesto or something like that. So they will go to a play. And so he was talking about a play called Marx in Soho. And so as we were talking, he said, you know, I'll probably want to produce this play at a theater and so on. Of course, I had no idea what producing a play means, but I said, I'll do it, you know, because it was a chance to spend more time with Howard, really. And it was a great decision because I, you know, I could figure things out fairly okay, you know. And so I ended up producing the play, Marx in Soho, but in the meantime, got to spend a ton of time with Howard. We'd come over to our house, we would talk about the play, we would exchange letters, phone calls, and so on. There was no email at that time. That, you know, we didn't do the internet stuff, but still, it gave us a chance to do a lot of in-person, you know, encounters and conversations over the telephone. And I became, you know, very much engaged in his life, and his memoir came out afterwards called "You Can't Be Neutral on a Moving Train." Which I helped to launch as well. One of the first places they came to was Busboys and Poets. And then, you know, when we opened our location in Hyattsville, I named the room in his honor, the Howard Zinn Room. Mm-hmm. So yeah, he still lives in my heart.
Okay. There's two other people that I want you to talk about, and that's Angela Davis and Alice Walker.
Mm. Yeah.
Talk about Angela first, because she wrote the foreword to your book.
Yeah, I mean, I always think that I've been such a fortunate human being, really, on this planet, and certainly in here, meeting some of the most really interesting people, I think, certainly in my life. Alice was this, it was, you know, sometimes you meet people and you feel like you known them all your life kind of thing. And Alice, very spiritual person. And she sort of,
if I'm not mistaken, I remember you, I think I introduced you to Alice. I think it was a thing.
I don't even remember, honestly.
Yeah. Because you were concerned about like meeting her for the first time.
Yeah. I mean, of course, you know, these are people that are bigger than life, you know,
right.
And all of a sudden you're like sitting next to them and you're having tea with them and having conversations with them. So, it, you know, Alice is very special. I still am in contact with her regularly. Once in a while, I'll get this wonderful text, you know, with hearts and flowers and beautiful things. And she's such a beautiful human being, really.
And Angela Davis?
And Angela, you know, of course, I remember, like, Angela, just a, like 2 years after we got here to the United States, her face was on every television network. Her afro and her profile was everywhere. Right. And it was like, who is this woman? Who is this, like, woman that everybody's after? Like, my God, what a powerful human being. And you know, I've read her memoir. This is my third time actually listening to it. I've been listening to it actually in the car. And she reads it. You know, she read her memoir for the audiobook. And it's such a, I mean, talk about being in the middle of history. You know, every page is like, I have to re-listen to it like 3 or 4 times just to get the depth of her engagement at so many levels. This is like, she's quite a figure for sure. I got to meet her not very long ago. I met her, I think, 2010, actually. I mean, she says that we met in 2013, but I met her before that. Mm-hmm. But in 2013, we did the Peace Ball, the inaugural Peace Ball for Obama's second term. And it was at Arena Stage. And she was one of the headliners that came along with Gina Dent, her partner. It was a great, great event. And I remember her speaking. And of course, the crowd was rapt, and it was very, you know, her words are so beautiful. And after she got off the stage, they, you know, with some music and stuff, and everybody was dancing. And I grabbed her by the arm, and we went on stage and danced together. And I thought,
just dancing through history, Andy. Just
dancing through history. Exactly. It's like I waltzed with her on the stage.
You know, like, all right. Yeah. You know, when I introduced you, Andy Shalah, I mentioned businessman and artist. And I want to talk about your artwork and especially your collages and murals. I think when you had the restaurant in Virginia, I think you slapped some paint on the wall there. But you really going to get into murals? It was just like paint on the wall to cover up the spots.
It was really because I didn't have that much time. Get the place open, quick, splash the paint.
But let's talk about this. I want to look at it because I want to talk about whether you have a style. And then I also want to look at the fact that some artists who come out of a Muslim or Islamic aesthetic might lean more towards the abstract as instead of depicting human figures. And so I just want to look at how you operate in terms of your murals.
Well, I think a lot of times there are thoughts that swim in my head that sometimes it's hard to explain, right? So I really wanted the murals because it's funny. I had an office in my home. This is before I opened Busboys and Poets. I had a small little corner in the house. It was my office. And on it, I had like these big photographs that were blown up of some of, you know, the most iconic figures, certainly as I was growing up in my life. Angela being one of them, Alice being another, Howard Zinn being another, and so on. And I had those photographs, and I had them made so big that I made them into like wallpaper. Because Marjan would let me stick stuff on the walls. But I had them like lined up, you know, so it fills up the entire wall. And so when I decided to open, and I used to have people like come to my house and say, oh, this is really cool. This is really cool. Mm. It's very interesting. So it became kind of a style. So right. When I decided to open Busboys and Poets, I decided to sort of wallpaper the room with some of those figures, and of course adding a lot more and telling a full story. Mm-hmm. So it's like the mural at 14th Street, which is the first location, had, you know, it's the social justice piece of struggle mural. So it has a lot of iconic figures in there. You being one of them.
Yeah. Well, you know, I'm not iconic, but
I think you are.
You know, one of the things I was looking at, and this ties in with Howard Zinn, If I look at Howard Zinn, he would probably conclude that people make history. But when I look at your artwork and your mural, it's you have individuals. And I'm just wondering whether that is. And then I would look at the mural that is sort of, I guess, lost now. But I felt one of the best murals that you did was the one that was in the IPS office when IPS was on 16th Street, because I really got a sense of what Howard Zinn was about, people making history
Right,
more
right,
so than
right.
individual. Just talk about that. Is that a correct
Well,
analysis?
yes and no, because I try to look, years ago, I had a chance to meet Coleman McCarthy, who's the great peace activist and writer for the Washington Post for many years. He was a columnist and runs the Institute for Peace. And Coleman used to say that in his classes, he used to say that people always can identify one or two peace activists, and oftentimes can identify presidents and generals and people like that, but they don't identify, they can't really name very many, people that have made a huge difference in how we as human beings have evolved. And a lot of these people, I think he would also say, and so would Howard, is that these are folks that aren't just individuals that just popped up out of nowhere. There were people that had movements behind them. They were lifted up instead of led. They were kind of pushed forward because of their whatever, for whatever reason, charisma, able to speak well, or whatever. But they're not alone. And I think oftentimes we do talk about the idea of this one person who came out of nowhere and suddenly saved the world. That's not how life, that's not how it works. Teaching for Change, which is one of the most, I think, really important NGOs here in the city, that talks about how it's beyond heroes on holidays. It is not just about an individual who just rises up from nowhere and becomes this important, iconic
Even though
figure.
we do know that when we pick up the book, a seat at the table, it does seem as if this individual rises from
Well, no, I think I tell the story. I think if you read the story, it's not so much like I woke up one day and opened Busboys and Poets. It doesn't work that way. And none of these people in here, none of the people in the book.
it does read a little biblical.
Well, yeah, the Bible, is the best-selling book in the world. So hey, that's not a bad thing to do.
And it's in two parts. We'll talk about
And
that
then later. Came the Quran, so we
But
don't
I
forget
want to.
that
Okay,
one.
well,
But
okay. I'm leaving. I'm not even going to mention anything. But I'm
I
not even
have
going to
those
mention anything
books, so
about the
I got
Baha'i faith. I'm just going to leave it to the Quran, and that's it. But I want to go from your artwork, Annie, and talk about your writing process, because we have this book, A Seat at the Table. But when I look at it, I feel that this book is an outgrowth of your journal and travel writing.
I would say I like writing. So for me, it's an enjoyable experience. It's not an easy experience for sure, but it's enjoyable. And it's funny because sometimes, like, one of my biggest challenges oftentimes as an artist is either putting paint on paper or ink on a paper or something to start. So the start is always really difficult. But I always think, like, once you start, stuff just flows out of you. It's like
Okay,
the
let's talk about the stuff that's flowing. Okay,
oh God.
not that way. What happened is that I just want okay, I want to make a connection between you in terms of, I mean, throughout this book, your description and your writing about food is really, what if we, and this is, I guess, like looking at it critically, what type of taste do you want to leave in your reader's mouth after reading this book? Is it salty? Is it spicy? Is it a sweet story?
I think something warm, for sure. I think something, I'd like them to walk away feeling nourished at some level, feeling a sense of like anything is possible kind of idea. So do I want them to walk away? Not spicy, I don't think. I don't think it's spicy is the I think more kind of I think I think comfort.
Okay, well, that was just my Oprah Winfrey question.
Yeah, that's not normally... I think more comforting.
That's not the best question. Yeah. It's like, you know, if you could be a cornflake, what type of cornflake would you be? I just wanted to ask that.
I would definitely be a frosted flake.
Okay, I say that before we end. I want to ask a question. Which you mentioned very early in your memoir. A Seat at the Table, Andy. You mentioned, and this I think is on page 21, you mentioned how movement can exact a toll on one's physical and mental health. I wonder if you could expand on that.
Oh yeah, for sure. I mean, we're in the middle of that right now. I mean, it's with the genocide that's happening in Gaza and all this stuff that's happening here with Mahmoud Khalil being abducted, other young people who are speaking truth to power are being picked up by ICE and abducted and not heard from for days sometimes. I find that to be quite disturbing and certainly exhausting. I think for people that are constantly following these types of things, after a while, it wears you out. You know, I think it's something, of course, what's happening in Gaza, for instance, is horrific for the people that live there. But we are also now, because we're so interconnected with the internet and Facebook and Instagram and TikTok and all that stuff, we're like living it in real time. And, you know, when you go to bed and you're looking at those images, and then you wake up and you're still looking at other images of the same horror, you're in the middle of a horror film, really, and it's quite disturbing. And I think it really does take a toll on you. And I've known many, many people who are activists who just have thrown their hands up in the air and just walked away.
Let's talk about people who are activists, but also people like yourself. And I'm wondering, you know, we were talking about, you know, your artwork. We were talking about, you know, your writing. Does your fact that you have those outlets, you know, art and writing, does that help you in terms of any sort of processing things in terms of, you know, the experience?
Oh, for absolute sure. I mean, yeah, absolutely. If I didn't have my art, if I didn't have my outlets, if I didn't find community, I mean, look, one of the reasons why I opened Busboys and Poets was the fact that I was feeling so isolated, so alone after 9/11. Being an Arab and a Muslim living in this country after 9/11 was hell at so many levels. There was this fear, this constant fear. I remember refusing to fly for many years after 9/11 because I was scared of what would happen. You know, what would happen when I get to that checkpoint? What will they say? What will they do?
Or if you're on a plane and you got up to go to the bathroom, somebody was like, how long have you been in the bathroom?
Exactly. Or if you had a shirt that maybe has
bulge
something
or
on
something,
it.
Yeah.
I mean, we saw many people getting pulled off, you know, planes because they had some Arabic writing on a shirt that said love or something like that. Right. You know, people, they see Arabic, they think, oh my God, a terrorist, you know? And I was, part of it was really trying to find my tribe, trying to find my community through Busboys and Poets. And of course, that became obvious once it was open. I saw how many people were really longing for this kind of a space where they can come together, intersect with people they may otherwise not intersect with, who maybe they thought were different in how they think, but actually they were on the same page. And it was kind of, it expanded the possibilities, I think, for people in their mind, what's possible when they see something.
Let's go back. We're going to take a little break, Andy, and then I want to ask you some more specific questions about Busboys and Poets. My guest today is Andy Shalah. He is the author of A Seat at the Table. The show's On the Margins. My name is E. Ethelbert Miller. The show's the station is WPFW 89.3 FM.
Peace! This is your social justice calendar for the week of March 24th, 2025. On March 27th from 6 to 8 p.m., Sankofa will honor Indigenous women through art at the Embassy of Columbia in Washington, D.C., 1724 Massachusetts Avenue. More info can be found on www.sankofa.com. Saturday, March 29th from 12 to 2 p.m., MedStar and Bread for the Soul will hold a colorectal cancer awareness month event, free luncheon and discussion on colon cancer, diabetes, and high blood pressure, located at Westminster Church on 400 Street, Southwest Washington, D.C. More info and to RSVP, contact 202-421-8608. On Sunday evening, 6 p.m. on March 30th at the National Press Club, the Emmett Till Legacy Foundation presents the Women of Courage Awards Gala in honor of Mamie Till Mobley, celebrating women who exemplify the strength, resilience, and courage of Mamie Till Mobley. For more info, you can visit Eventbrite. The WPFW Social Justice Calendar connects you with the heartbeat of grassroots activism in the DMV. Submissions can be emailed to socialjustice@wpfw.org. Please include the name, date, and address of the event. Submissions are due by Thursday at 5 p.m. at least 1 week in advance of your event. WPFW Social Justice Calendar helps build a better world, one broadcast at a time.
Okay, we're back on the margin with my guest, Andy Shalah, the founder of Busboys and Poets and the author of A Seat at the Table. Andy, you write in your memoir, A Seat at the Table, you talk about service in your memoir. You state that you cannot train someone to serve. And I want you to expand on that because, I mean, you have many servers in your restaurant. What do you look for when you're selecting somebody that you're going to employ?
It requires someone who gets joy out of other people's joy. It really does. It requires someone who is willing to not see service as something beneath them. There are some people that feel service is something that, you know, it's not their thing. And I've always seen service as being the most honorable thing you can do. When you put food in front of somebody, when you're feeding someone, it really does touch their soul. And you can make a difference in people's lives. And I've seen it happen over and over again. So I see service as a very spiritual and honorable profession and job. And sometimes people go into it by default because they either are looking for a quick job or trying to do something, you know, in the meantime while they're thinking of something else. It's not that easy to train someone. I don't think it's even possible to train someone to love to serve.
You know, that's why I looked at it in terms of some societies. You know, the one is forced to serve because of issues of caste. You know, where you only think about serving.
Right. I mean, you're right. I mean, there are certain societies. You're absolutely right. Oftentimes, brown societies that are. You know, that's the only option they have. So they groom people to be that, you know. I mean, if you've ever been on a cruise or something like that, you end up with a lot of people from Southeast Asia, from people like that, who end up to be the people that do the serving. And they have schools and programs and, you know, they train people to do that from early on.
You know, many times in a memoir, we find out something about an individual that perhaps we didn't know, and or something that's very personal that we find the writer writing about. When I looked at your book, A Seat at the Table, you reveal in your book that you stutter and you had special therapy for it. I mean, I was wondering, since we were talking about when you came to this country at the age of 11, whether when you were stuttering, whether that became an issue you were teased at when you were young, and then how did you accomplish things like that?
Well, kids tease you for anything. I mean, I think it's probably less so today than it was then, although the teasing may have evolved in different ways. But it was definitely a handicap, and it definitely prevented me from certainly doing many things. I mean, I avoided situations that would require me to open my mouth. I mean, it was just that simple. You know, like giving a book report in class, I had to fake sickness. I had to I had to pretend like I just was dying or something like that. And then I would just leave and go to the bathroom, spend the day in the, I mean, the hours in the bathroom sometimes, just because they want to escape from the possibility of being called. But that was a very scary time.
Yeah, and it's interesting. I was looking at that, and then I noticed something. This is a close reading, that you were dealing with that, but a person that helped you get through that was your first wife, who was, I think, yes, a speech with us. So talk about that, because it seems like, okay, I'm just going to write about
her. I married my therapist. I married my
therapist. And then I was also looking at that you married an older woman.
Yes, she was my therapist. She was the one that...
This is like...
I don't think it's legal.
you know what? I don't know anything about the licensing and the zoning stuff of your, but in reading your book, there's a couple of violations that you made. Okay, you dated your therapist. I didn't even get to Marjan, who you're right where you met her. You shouldn't have been talking to her because you guys were at the same place. Andy,
it was a work rule. There was Andy, a work rule that you couldn't do
Andy,
that.
Andy,
yes,
this is what we hear in the news. You have to set accountability.
I get it.
Well, I'm saying this because you're writing about this and you have to make a decision. Okay, how much am I going to mention somebody that it was helpful at this particular point in my life, but is not the key part of my life anymore?
Well, it's interesting because that's really kind of the big challenge. The editor I was working with, you know, noticed certain glaring things, and he says, "Do you really want to put this there?" And you know, I had to think twice about doing that because I'm not a writer per se, so this is my first book, and so for me it was kind of like when you read the book, he said, you know, I was writing about a certain person. He says, "You don't like that person, do you?" And I said, "Oh my God, I didn't realize that that came out in the writing," and so I had to kind of change those things. Say, I'm not there to hurt people. This is not about, you know, settling scores or getting.
Well, let's look at what this is about. let's look at what this is about. You know, if I open a book, this book is dedicated to Marjan.
Okay. Yes.
And I recall something that Marjan was, this is when you guys lived in Virginia. And I remember Marjan was so concerned about you working late and driving, you know, leaving bus boy and driving. This is when it was just one bus boy and driving back and really saying, you know, really that concern about, you know, you. And I felt, here's a love story. Okay. But I felt that I didn't see her developing as a character. The same way when I look at busboys, I look at Yazir, your brother, who I feel was, I always like talking to him because it's like, yeah, Andy comes up with these ideas, but I got to do the work. but I felt there was a lot of love. And I, the thing that I wish, and a photo I lost, was when you were running for mayor and you announced at Ben Chilliwell, your entire family was in the alley.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
And you know, everybody was so happy, you know,
and
I felt, okay, talking about what you're saying about the book and the taste of nourishment, I felt you were nourishing the city. I felt that when I look at this book being dedicated to Marjan, this is a love story, that there probably would be no busboys if it hadn't been a person saying, okay, I'll figure this out. I'll work with you on this one.
Well, I mean, you know, always they... You know, the second one is always the charm, right? So maybe it's a third.
In baseball, you get three pitches, but that's another issue.
but it's it was interesting because I knew that I was really committed to my work, and you know, I find a lot of satisfaction in work and in service, and you know, when I was with Marjan, I was working at a hotel. It was in food and beverage, and you know, working super hard. And you know, hotels are a lot of work, like many other jobs. And I was, you know, when we decided that we may want to get married, my first thing to her was, look, my work comes first. And I just want you to know that, because I know that there are some relationships where there are certain expectations, and when those expectations aren't met, there's a lot of conflict that comes around that. And I know that that sounds really bad for people to hear that work comes first, but I wanted to be honest because it really does in many ways, you know.
But it goes back to the beginning of this conversation when I asked you about the immigrant story. We know that there are many men who are working these long hours, and there's women who are taking care of the family and raising the kids, and you know, yep. And maybe they have a job. But what happened, a lot of weight rests on women in immigrant households, you know, either, you know, dealing with family or dealing with really backbending work and then coming home and dealing with their own families. And so I felt there was a story here that was one that was very interesting in terms of you dedicated this book to Marjan, and I felt that was very important. I want to get into some other things that I found was interesting. You wound up going to college at like 15. You had Catholic, I mean, right there, I could see somebody, you know, like throwing, like not, you know, beating you up or whatever, taking your book.
Right.
You know, how was that in terms of just having people look upon you as peers?
Well, I lied about my age. I didn't tell people.
You see, here we go again, Andy.
Yes.
Lying. you know, somebody's going to say, I'm not eating at your restaurant, brother.
Wait a minute. That's not fair. That is totally
I'm just
fair.
Listening to you.
First of all, as a kid, 15 years old, going to college, I had to pretend I was older. I couldn't get a date otherwise, and I couldn't.
We're not talking about your love life.
I couldn't get a beer. You know, back then you were able to drink at 18. You know, back those days. But so I had to pretend I was 18, and you know, people didn't check IDs back then, so it didn't matter. But anyway, it wasn't easy. And I think oftentimes, like, you know, I advise parents now, like if they say, "Oh, my kid is moving forward fast," I said, "Stop it. Do not push him or her, because there's so much more to education than just getting A's."
Right.
You know, there's the emotional and the physical and all of that other stuff that comes with it. And, you know, if I had to do it over again, I would definitely not recommend moving forward.
Listen, talking about do-overs, let's get something critical out here.
Do-overs, okay. Oh, no. I think that do-overs are so weird.
So you're starting out. Why, explain this to me, why is a guy from Iraq opening an Italian restaurant? And don't tell me the letters begin with the same letter. Well, this cultural appropriation?
I mean, Italian food is super popular. Right. So
Andy, hold it. You also opened up Eatonville. So, you know, don't give me this
true.
Thing.
Well, I think I was at a different stage of my life at that point. You know, I really was, you know, moving toward more of a cultural connection as opposed to just a business. You know, when you introduced me as a businessman and artist, I think I'm an artist and businessman. I'm not.
Andy,
it's not the other way around.
Andy, yeah, in these times, Andy.
Would you let me finish?
No, I'm gonna interrupt you. If I came in right now, how you look, and I walked into you, and you got Italian, I say you look like Mussolini with your forehead.
Right, exactly. Well, you know, you learn to code switch early on, you know, because as an Arab and a Muslim living in this country. And especially back then in 1968 or whatever, you know, trying to serve people food, saying you're Arab and Muslim was not going to be a good thing. It just wasn't going to work. And so for me, it was like trying to blend. You know, first of all, I had the advantage of not speaking because, you know, I was stuttering at that time. So it was kind of like kept it as low key as possible when it comes to saying stuff. And then, you know, having to serve people, I just kind of like worked really hard, made sure that they were having a good time rather than allow conversations to take shape or someone to complain about something. So, you know, it's blending was important.
I see. It's like the menu.
A little bit of that. Fusion. That's what it's called.
Okay. You know, One of the things I think people would look at, you've got about 8 busboys as we're on the air right now. We don't know what's happening in the future. But what when you look up, and what is you would say is key to your success as a businessman? We were talking about you as an artist. What is key to you as a business person?
I think the key for the type of business that I do is authenticity. I think being able to be authentic, because I don't put the business ahead of the purpose. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. I always think that the purpose of Busboys and Poets is to create a space that brings people together, that has politics and art, culture colliding together in a very special way. And that's really the most important part of what we do. If it doesn't, like, I don't go seeking to open places. I don't go looking. I don't have scouts going around looking for spaces to do a Busboys and Poets. Oftentimes it's a landlord or someone that wants us to be there. And I oftentimes don't even answer those calls unless there's 3 or 4 times before I answer that call. If somebody really wants a Busboys and Poets there, they really want to have that kind of, you know, space of cultural connections that they care about, that they want to have in their community, then I would consider doing it. But I don't do it just to do it.
Well, you know, if I read, a seat at the table, which you just produced, it seems that there is no Busboys and Poets unless it's a Black bank. You get a loan from an industrial bank.
Absolutely.
You were rejected money loan from Riggs and the Bank of America. So here you see a key thing in terms of the importance of Black institutions in terms of taking risk with business.
Absolutely. I owe so much to Industrial Bank. I've told them that many, many times. And I've gotten other loans from them because of it. You know, they've been a really great go-to place for me. They got it, you know, oftentimes. I would go into a place in a bank and I would say, I'm opening a place that has poetry and books and coffee and big seats. And they look at me like, and how are you going to make money? And mm-hmm. It was like, okay, well, you know, it'll happen. Like somehow it'll happen, you know, and they just don't get it. When I went to Industrial Bank, I think they got a sense of what this place could be. The connections to the U Street corridor, the Black Broadway and all that. I think it was important for them to be able to have that be in that community because it's right around the corner from the bank. And you know, it's interesting because it's how the alchemy of the universe sometimes takes shape. You know, the building that was going up was called the Langston Lofts. Mm-hmm. And it was, of course, named after Langston Hughes. But I also knew that most of the people that are moving in there have no idea what the Langston Lofts is named after. Maybe it was like the son of the developer or something named Langston, you know, who knows? Just like, you know, the Ellington building.
Well, the one I think about is the Reeves Center because Reeves is named after the attorney that was defending Langston during the 1950s.
Exactly. Right. During the Red Scare. Yep. Right. So, it's fascinating.
Well, this is a question that somebody might say, okay, so Busboy opens up in 2005. It's extremely successful. And someone would say, you know, now maybe Andy's becoming a chain like McDonald's or something like that. Like, why don't you just be content with one and that's it, you know? That's just what my mother would say, you know, Ethelbert, yeah. just write one poem. We don't need a book.
Well, I think for a couple of reasons, I would be totally content with one. It's not that. I mean, I think for me, it was, there was a lot of pressure to open another one. You know, like developers were coming at me like crazy. And of course, then I have staff, I have management, I have people that are, you know, kitchen managers and front of the house managers and other people who want to move into that. And if you have one place, you have a very limited amount of opportunities for people to move up. You know, you only have like 1 or 2 positions that they can move into. It's like DC in politics, you know, there's only two positions to be in.
and you don't even get a stove that works.
Exactly. There's that. But so the idea of you know, people who want to grow within the company, I think made it impossible unless there was some growth, the company itself, you know, to go beyond where the confines of the four walls. And so we opened another one. Suddenly people have opportunities. They're able to move up into management, become directors, et cetera, et cetera. And then, you know, comes another one, and then another one, then another one. So, and then now we have, you know, very solid.
Well, let's look at something you were before, yeah, when it was just one. You were going through chefs the way, you know, a bad team goes through relief pitchers. what happened is, like, you would say that either the food wasn't making it or they didn't get what you know, they were cooking food with an attitude, you know, and that wasn't making it.
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of times, you know, with chefs, there is this constant struggle between the chef and the restaurant. And oftentimes chefs want to be at the front. They want to have the light shine on them, you know? And a lot of times it's the restaurant and the customers that make the restaurant are the ones that need to have the light shine on them. And, you know, I wanted to make sure that whoever is going to be doing the food is focused on the guest and the purpose of the space as opposed to their interests.
But wasn't this a city at a point in time where it was a hot place for chefs, restaurants were opening up, and there was, like, I mean, I remember you had me involved in some sort of chef test.
Yeah, exactly. I remember that. Yeah, that was when we were doing the chef search for Edenville.
Right, right.
Yeah. which is a whole different story. That's a whole different book by itself.
No, that's why I would have said, you know, whoever got this, who's the brother who had this is my mother's potato salad and chicken, and it wasn't even aesthetically pleasing, you know what I'm saying?
Well, you know, that's exactly what you said. A lot of people call themselves chefs because they know how to cook one dish, you know. That's not what a chef is. A chef is also a person who can lead a group of people, who can also manage a kitchen, who can make sure that the food is consistent and is put out on a daily basis. Like being, you know, it's interesting because I think one of the most important jobs in a kitchen is the line cook, is not the chef. Because the chef creates this wonderful dish and you can sit down and say, delicious, amazing, you know. But then can you make that same dish over and over again 100 times a day for a year without faltering? That's really what makes the difference, because it doesn't matter if you do the tasting. The tasting is good. If it doesn't reproduce well and reproduces often and consistently, it's useless.
Okay, my last question before we have to go, Andy Shalaw. What's your...
Already? So
hey, man, it's just like, you know, we're eating and all of a sudden all the food's gone. What happens is that...
There's always more.
But I just want to, in terms of changing city, what is your vision in terms of how the city's going to survive the next couple of years?
I mean, for restaurants, it's been really tough. I just saw a report yesterday that was put out by WJLA TV. They said, I think from the Restaurant Association, they said 2/3 of casual dining restaurants will be closing by the end of this year. Disturbing. And I think a lot of it has to do, of course, with, you know, some of the increases in wages and other things that have happened that were absolutely necessary, but also with the federal government and what's happening around us. You know, this is a federal government city, and for many years it was really insulated from the ups and downs.
Yeah, we might be like a factory town in Ohio.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. So we've been insulated from the ups and downs of the economy, really, in many ways. When other cities were facing, you know, dire situations, we were able to survive because of the federal government. And now that's about to evaporate. that's not going to be.
Well, I'm going to go back as we end of the show. I'm going to say we survive, and I remember the South African poet Dennis Brewis wrote this book, and somehow we survive.
Yeah.
And I think that's going to be very interesting at that, as we also listen to the blues and to tell people that the blues is not just a fruit of sadness, but it also can be joyous. And so we have to make sure that. Andy, I want to thank you for writing.
It's a song of resistance.
Resistance. I want to thank you for writing this book, A Seat at the Table. I've enjoyed reading it, and I admire you, and I just want to thank you for being on my show. My guest today has been Andy
Shalaw. Always fun talking to you.
Okay, my guest today has been Andy Shalaw, the author of Seat at the Table. My name is E. Ethelbert Miller. The show's on the margin. The station's WPFW 89.3 FM.
New African Film Festival, presented by AFI and Africa World Now Project at AFI Silver Theater and Cultural Center in downtown Silver Spring from March 14 to the 27th. The festival features 29 films from 19 countries, discussions with filmmakers, and more. The 2025 New African Film Festival features the diversity of new filmmaking from Africa. Tickman 00, that's 301-495-6700. WPFW, building a better world, one broadcast at a time.
WPFW presents Still We Rise, our 48th anniversary celebration on Friday, April 25th, 7 to 11 p.m. at Martin's Crosswinds in Greenbelt. Entertainment includes Navasha Deya and more. That's Still We Rise, WPFW's 48th anniversary celebration. Details at WPFWFM.org.
On Sunday, March 30th at 6 p.m., at the National Press Club, the Emmett Till Legacy Foundation presents the Woman of Courage Awards Gala in honor of Mammy Till Mobley, the mother of Emmett Till, celebrating women who exemplify the strength, resilience, and courage of Mammy Till Mobley. Activist ancestor Dori Latner and her sister Joyce are among 18 honorees who embody Mammy Till Mobley's unwavering courage that ignites the civil rights movement and continues to inspire generations today. Details at Eventbrite under Women of Courage Awards Gala. WPFW, building a better world, one broadcast at a time.
Hey, this is Alvin Nedab, your host of Music Memories, and my co-host,
Deborah Nedab.
And guess what, Deborah?
What?
We're moving.
We're moving?
That's right. We're moving from Mondays, 2 a.m. to 5 a.m. to Saturdays, 2 a.m. to 5 a.m. starting next Saturday, March 22nd. And Deborah, guess what?
What?
We're going to still continue to play the best old school music of all time. So we just want you to be there. 89.3.
Are you in the process of writing or updating your will, trust, or estate plan? We invite you to consider adding WPFW as a beneficiary through a charitable bequest. Bequests can take many forms and are usually the largest and most impactful gift a donor will ever make. Your bequest will help to ensure the programming WPFW has provided for almost 50 years will continue into the future. More info available by email at plannedgiving@wpfw.org or by phone at 202-588-0999, extension 344. Or you can let us know you've already included PFW in your plans through those same channels so we can add your name to our growing list of legacy listeners. We are listener supported. We are Jazz and Justice. And because of your support, we are WPFW.
Jazz lovers, the 15th Annual Washington Women in Jazz Festival is back with a weekend of performances, workshops, and jam sessions at the Penn Arts Mansion in Washington, D.C. on March 29th and 30th. From interactive workshops to concerts and late-night jams, there's something for everyone. Details at WashingtonWomenInJazz.com. WPFW, building a better world, one broadcast at a time.
Hello, WPFW. Festival season is here, and on April 6, noon until 7:30 p.m., Words, Beats, and Life kicks it off with the Jazz and Blossoms Park Jam. Family-friendly activities, art activations, food truck vendors, and performances will all happen in Franklin Park. Details at wblinc.org/wblfest.